And a good hello to everybody over on YouTube. As we have our first edition of Overtime in a long time. I think the last one we did was sometime in March. Well, we've been doing a lot, okay? We've been really, really busy traveling and things like that. Kyle, did you make it okay?
Hi.
Okay, you're in the same room as me, so yeah, I imagine you did. Rob, Gila, how are you guys doing? Did you make it?
We are well here. And we sound good on YouTube.
Okay, sounds good. And Alex, I see you as well.
I am here, only temporarily though. I'll hang out for a few minutes, say hello to some people, and then I got to jump, unfortunately.
Okay, I understand. We could do like a 5-hour show with all the things I have so many things to talk about, and we wound up talking about a couple of them because we just get into these conversations, which are always fascinating. But I did do a little bit more research on the story of the wallpaper guy from Germany. Apparently, this guy Bohm, B-O-H-M-E, previously tried to sue the granddaughter in the courts in Dusseldorf and Stuttgart in Germany, but he was unsuccessful in his legal attempts there. The regional court and higher regional court of Dusseldorf ruled that Bohm had implicitly granted a license by selling the wallpaper on the one hand, and that his lawsuits were an abuse of rights on the other. Wow, does that happen often, Alex, when you file a lawsuit and then the judge says that your lawsuit is an abuse of rights? Because that's got to hurt.
No, but it very much in tune with the principle that I had mentioned before, that, you know, this is essentially a trifle, right? You know, there really aren't damages here. This guy's being an idiot. And he got called out for it.
I hope he doesn't sue you for saying that.
No, if he does, I mean, I guess it would be on the basis of defamation. A defense to defamation is the truth. So I just have to prove that he's an idiot.
Okay, well, that shouldn't take too long. Well, I don't mean to get myself into this by saying that. Anyway, so you might wonder if his lawsuit was seen as an abuse of rights. How is he still suing? Well, while other German courts have rejected his argument, what he's doing now is hoping for a victory when his copyright case is heard in Cologne Region Court on June 27th. He previously won a similar copyright case regarding an image with his photo-based wallpaper at Cologne Regional Court last year. That lawsuit was also against a landlady of a vacation apartment. Now, when it comes to copyright, the Cologne Regional Court says that a strict duty of care applies and that anyone who makes use of other people's photographs by publishing them on their website must ensure that this is done with the permission of the authorized person. No, I'm sorry. That's crap. You're in your own damn house. You're taking a picture of your wall. How much more personal can you possibly get to say that's copyright infringement? Alex, help me out here. This is insane, right? This is not where the legal world is going, is it?
Well, I'm not an expert in German law, but I would imagine that under German legal principles, they would have very similar types of ideals that we would have with respect to copyright. And this seems like it might come into the principle of first sale might come into play here. Namely, that when you buy that particular wallpaper, even though it's comprised of other photos, you have the right to do with that instance of those photos what you will. You can deface them. You can take pictures of them. It's not as if the person would be distributing them or printing them for some kind of commercial purpose. That, I think, would squarely violate the copyright rights of the original photographer of that particular work if they were replicating the work.
Right, a commercial purpose involving the work, not a commercial purpose involving renting out the room.
And solely the work, too. I think that's what's really important here, is that his work is not isolated by itself in the photographs. It's part of their house, as you mentioned, Emmanuel. So it's just one of many items in the house. Everything that you create can have a copyright to it. If you create source code, even though you don't file for in the U.S. Copyright Office, you automatically have a source. You automatically have a copyright to that particular source code, so long as it's unique, and you created it. So this whole idea of running around the world and forum shopping and looking for photographs with your copyrighted items in it, if this is a legal principle that will stand on its own, it will create absolute havoc and destroy our ability to share and distribute images online. It's just, it would work to such absurdity that I think this guy, that the case has to be dismissed.
Rob Gila, you both have your hands up, so fight amongst yourselves.
Well, this is what I was thinking at the end of our over-the-air show, is are we sure this is really the guy? And I'm not even joking. Do we know that this is actually What's-His-Bucket-Boehm, and it's not somebody pretending to be him who's just running around looking for his stuff? Or is Boehm's career so sad now that he can't, like, he's only making a living off of suing people at, like, the Westboro Baptist Church? And
are you attacking him or defending him? I can't figure it out.
I'm not 100% sure myself. But yesterday we were talking about, Rob and I were talking about Terry Jacks. You ever Terry Jacks?
Terry Jacks, yeah. He did, what was the song he did?
Seasons in the Sun.
Seasons in the Sun.
Right. But you know the thing about Terry Jacks?
No.
Okay, this is 100% true. Terry Jacks, Seasons in the Sun, what, 1972?
We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the hills
Absolutely.
That we climb were just something in my mind.
Seasons out of time.
Whatever, yeah. It was a cool
and
song.
And it's an incredibly, it's a pretty song, it's incredibly depressing. But Terry Jacks, it was a big hit in, like, what, 72? And he toured and did all that stuff until about 75, and then he just vanished. And then a few years later, some dude turned up and said, hey, I'm Terry Jacks, and he started giving concerts and giving interviews and going on tour claiming he was Terry Jacks. The world believed him because they didn't know any better. And then he got sick of it, turned himself in to the real Terry Jacks, and everybody thought it was over. But then a few years later, he started doing it again, and this time he was, like, getting hotel rooms and not paying for them and giving bad concerts and not showing up. And the real Terry Jacks was like, dude, you're destroying my name. I need you to stop again. So I'm wondering if What's-His-Face Boehm is really doing this, or, like, it's a Terry Jacks situation.
Well, this guy went to court and won, so that takes a lot of balls. If you're going to impersonate somebody and go to court in their name and win and then try it again. I don't know. But I'm fascinated by the Terry Jacks story now. I got to look into that because, boy, how do you get away with that at all? I mean, don't the fans know that that's not the guy that sang the song?
I mean, it was the 70s and the 80s. It was about 10 years later. He might have looked different, but it had been about 10 years later. And this is, you know, pre-internet, so nobody knew.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, Rob, go ahead.
Yeah, I can only speak about this from the perspective of an artist. I am an artist. I have, you know, sold my work. I have given away my work. I have work on walls that are not mine. And sometimes I get a photo of my work on one of those walls. And that makes me so freaking happy. How is this guy angered or believes he's owed more by somebody who purchased a bit of his work? I'm guessing didn't accept any outlandish terms of service before they got this wallpaper and used it, and then wanted to show off their pretty room.
But, Rob, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if somebody purchased your art legitimately, if they mm-hmm. stole your art, if they, you know, did something, they copied it themselves, and they put it on the wall, and they took a picture of it. That's not the crime. The crime is the stealing part of it. That's what you get them for, but not for taking a picture of something in somebody's house. I don't care if it's a Mona Lisa or whatever. It's your house or, you know, a building outside. There are people who try to say this building is protected. It's a landmark. You can't take a picture of it. That's ridiculous. Of course you can. I'm sorry for interrupting. Go ahead.
No, there. If you take a picture from my point of view where I'm sitting right now at my computer desk, there are posters on the wall that I didn't design but I bought. There's artwork on the wall from artists I like that I either bought or was given. There are little figurines sculpted. There are action figures. There's desk toys. All this stuff. Comic books.
Professional photographs.
You know, stuff that I did not create, but that if I take a picture of my room, that's a picture of my room. That is not hurting the commercial value of any of the junk I happen to be surrounded by.
Wow. Kyle, do you have something?
I think it's a reach for sure. Like the thing that she's doing commercially is in the realm of a space to rent, and the photograph she took is of decor that I think, as was mentioned here, all great points by the way. The is an assemblage of multiple aspects of the space and the physical property itself. So that's the commercial sell, of which this wall covering is a part. And I think that that's a pretty good argument. It's not that she is selling copies of wallpaper that has this man's art.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that would be a competitive, like, violation of his product. Like, you're competing with intellectual property that is essentially his work, which mm-hmm. anybody would view that way. And I think that's probably, like, the healthiest view. I understand the competitiveness, being someone that's involved in the visual arts and takes photos myself. You know, the temptation is there to be so guarded. And there are, like Alex said, firms that will broker and otherwise manage the licensing of your art and chase down with well-resourced legal teams and departments. I even applied for a position one time. I didn't really realize what it was at the time.
Oh, wow.
But, there's jobs, people's entire tasks, and probably what we've seen more of now, because that was many years ago, mm-hmm. is the automation of it.
Yeah.
Where these letters just appear. So we've covered this on our cover
mm-hmm.
of all things, but there's so many people that are being affected by the automated nature of this.
Well, you're talking about Splotchgate, where we got a letter because random paint splotches were identified by some computer as part of some piece of art, and even the people running the company that sent that agreed it was ridiculous and immediately withdrew it as soon as we started complaining about it. But I should point out that did not happen because of the cover that went out to newsstands. It happened when the cover showed up on our store on the internet, and some computer came out and crawled and found it that way.
And just, it became just another job
mm-hmm.
in its task.
And we're buying into that world of litigiousness, if that's the right word, that just define our existence. You know, it's absurd to me that somebody has to live in fear if they're making a documentary and somebody drives by and you hear a snippet of a song that's playing through their stereo as they drive by and they've got to go and edit that out. That's insane. What exactly are you protecting? You think somebody is going to go out there and say, hey, there's a song. I'm going to grab 4 seconds of it and wait for another car to come by 10 seconds later in the song, and eventually I'll piece it together, and I'll get this 99-cent song for free. I mean, what is the logic? It makes absolutely no sense, but what it does is it cripples creativity, makes us all paranoid, looking over our shoulders. Look, we're on YouTube right now. There's an image of the 2600 van right there, and that image of the 2600 van is a van that's made to look like a phone company van of old. Now, imagine the phone company was still around using that emblem, those colors. They could say, you guys aren't allowed to do that. You guys aren't allowed to probably, A, have a van that has that paint job, but also you can't take a picture of that and display it on the internet. I mean, I think we'd all be seeing red to actually, you know, be confronted with some idiocy like that. But that, it's becoming the norm more and more, where an image or a sound or even a thought is copyrighted and protected. Go ahead, Rob.
I think a good analogy would be if Ford, who made the van in the first place, decided to sue you for showing.
It was Dodge. It was a Dodge van.
Dodge. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So Dodge, who manufactured the van in the first place and owned the design to that van, then sued you for publishing a photo of it, even though you bought it, you know, because it's a van and it happens to be that shape.
And as it happens, Ford did sue us for a different reason.
Well, worth also noting, it doesn't get to these levels of absurdity if there's not a legal market for these sort of situations. And I think this story is a symptom of a sort of intellectual property market that may be a bit flawed right now, and copyright as well. But the gain by pursuing one particular van, like the legal cost, and even for their their corporation, which is probably, you know, has ample resources, right, to come after that. The gain to go after our van or an individual, like just hosting an image of an apartment, is it's fraught. So, like, a corporation, I don't it's a lot more than the cost of actually pursuing it. The cost to do it is a lot more than what would be too gained to collect from that person that you are yeah. grieving or you're seeking a legal grievance.
If the cost comes down, but I think that's what's happening. The cost is coming down.
Well,
when things are automated.
Yeah. So, and that may be a part of what is flawed in this copyright system,
mm-hmm.
because we're not living in a world where we come from a time when this didn't exist. These things are emerging, and I think our experience with that is like we're tempted, and I heard that a lot in the conversation, like the exclamation of what world do we live in where we would want this? Well, the people pursuing these kinds of things see a value in it. If they can cast a wide enough or a large enough net by using the tools and information that is available of this day. So that's kind of what we're up against. So you have to kind of calibrate your expectations. And I think that's why people that are growing up with this might not really see the implication because it's sort of invisible, or we kind of accept it and self-censor along the way or don't want to react to it.
I think what you just said is meaningful in the way that we come from a different time. I think we need to preface a lot of conversations with we're from a different century, because we are. Go ahead, Gila.
Well, okay, now I have another theory as to why this is happening. Do we think that Wallpaper Guy is trying to rent out his own vacation apartment, so he's trying to get other people to take down their listings. He's trying to bully people out of putting up this image to get them out of the marketplace.
You're twisting yourself into a pretzel defending him. I mean, you think
I'm
it's
not defending
because,
him
well,
case,
you, he wants to rent out a bed and breakfast, and this is somehow preventing him from doing that because people might be confused and see his image on a different wall.
You know what's...
No, it's right. He's trying to knock out the competition.
Right.
I think this guy is.
Well, that's
horrible.
The American way.
And he's escalating.
Okay, here's the escalation. Right. If I was this person,
I want to get a call. I want him to call us.
I would take the picture that's on the website, use a wallpaper print-on-demand service to make like a pattern with that picture, then recover the walls with her photo of the old room with his photo on it so that it's like a pattern in the new space, then take a photo of the room with her new wall covering that is a pattern of all the other older pictures that were on the website, and then argue that it's her own work that is now the wall cover.
I want to see a photo of people urinating on it. I really do. That's what I think about this. It's that upsetting. But the funny thing is, I read this story from... where did I get this from? Petapixel.com. And you see the story there, Kyle? You guys see the story of a chair against the wallpaper? That's not even the wallpaper. For some reason, they didn't put the image in the front of the story.
Right,
the image,
that doesn't look like a photo.
No,
that's
it shows the stock image. For some reason, they didn't dare put the actual wallpaper in the story until you go a couple of pages in.
Ah.
And then it just looks like a bunch of stones top of each other.
It's like stacked rock, stacked... rocks.
And what, he took a picture of stacked rocks? How about the person who stacked the rocks? Don't they have some say in this? Because somebody did that.
Yeah, that doesn't look natural. That looks like a very large wall. And it's just a texture.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Okay. Oh, my God. Alice, you look like Mr. Robot. He suddenly appeared in a hoodie and wasn't expecting that.
Do we even know that, Alex?
Yeah, it's a little cold here.
Are you in Pennsylvania?
I'm in Pennsylvania at the moment. There's massive thunderstorms and lightning, and the temperature has dropped considerably.
You know, we got hit by lightning last week, and it's funny because the cable TV went out, and the cable company said, no, you don't have an outage, even though everybody in the neighborhood was out. They refused to believe it. And I had to sit through 10 minutes of talking to an automated response system that would say, what is the problem? You can only answer a certain way. And I said, cable is out. We suggest that you reboot your cable system. Do that by unplugging it. There's no way, I can't say representative, a screaming representative at the top of my lungs, wasn't doing anything. They said, unplug it now, I will wait 6 minutes while it boots back up. And I'm like, I did that already, you moron. Now I have to wait, 6 minutes before I can even get to a human. And by the way, the human didn't believe me either. I had to convince them that there actually was an outage. And 2 hours later, on the outage map, I was so happy. I saw a little dot show up. That was the outage I reported. And sure enough, they figured it out and eventually fixed it. But boy, what they put you through these days is just unreal. What happened to the days where you could call somebody and say, hey, there's a problem. You might want to look into it.
Yeah, those are gone. Those days are gone. But while we're on the subject of personal appearances, I wonder if that lightning strike had anything to do with the lack of facial hair of both you and Kyle these days. I just noticed you guys are looking pretty clean shaven.
Well, you don't know what we look like normally, because what you see usually, and people don't see this, you see, how when you pull off a job and you replace the tape in the surveillance cameras with old footage so that people are fooled?
It's a filter.
Yeah, that's what you've been seeing. This is a filter.
Is that right?
It is.
Yeah.
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 It's amazing. I felt like I'm looking back in time here or something. I was wondering why. I just felt a certain amount of disquietude during this whole show.
Well, we're not going to discuss your face.
Yeah.
Because...
Yeah. Well, I've got a face for radio.
Well, you said it, not me. But we have a phone for radio. Let's give out the phone number because we haven't heard from our listeners in forever. 802-321-4225. Hey, I remember the phone number after all this time. 802-321-HACK. If anybody is out there and wants to call us and say hi or have a question or a comment. And Gila, you have a question or a comment. Go ahead.
I do, but it's not mine. So, first of all, we're like 20 minutes in, and I have not said hello and welcome back to the 39 people who are with us on YouTube right now. Super glad to have you all here. We have a comment. Ray Kuhn says, why does Emmanuel still have cable TV? There are so many alternatives.
Oh, my God. Here we go again. Here we go again. It's the whole grandpa thing. You still have cable TV?
Don't respond.
Yeah, you know what? I still have all kinds of things. I have a non-electric razor, too.
We have token ring.
Yeah, judging for what kind of technology, I should have whatever I want to be able to have. And if I'm paying for it, it should work. And if I'm not paying for it, it should work, too, because, people never used to pay for TV. I'm from a different century. I know these things.
Yeah, I'm going to push the RDO button just to see what happens.
The what button?
I'm doing it.
Oh, okay. You know what?
I don't even know if this existed when checking connection.
It's going to be a dialogue.
What happened?
Okay, unfortunately.
Is she okay?
Okay, so this pulled up an App Store entry for the app, which is not on this TV, and with an apology.
That says, unfortunately, I can't look and talk at the same time. It says, unfortunately, RDO has shut down and is no longer available on your Roku device. We're sad to see them go, but we have more than 100 other streaming music services for you. Just go to streaming channels on your home screen and select the music category.
But that's the whole reason you got Roku in the first place. Everything is ruined now.
And that's also the only thing one of the biggest buttons on this remote now does.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what about the button? Now it's just wasted real estate on your remote. What Alex was saying before about this being an advertisement in your house, we should start billing them for advertising in our homes when we had no say in that.
I agree.
Yeah. You want to be litigious, we can do that too. Do we have a phone call?
They're certainly billing the advertisers for the opportunity to advertise to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We can litige. We can litige with the best of them.
Kyle, do we have a call?
Yo, no say. Yes.
I don't know what that means. Is that yes or no?
We have a call.
You literally said yes and no at the same time. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime. Go ahead.
Hola. It's Johnny Fusion.
Hey, how you doing, Johnny Fusion? From West Coast, right?
Yeah, Bay Area.
Bay Area. Cool. What's on your mind?
Hola.
Hey, how's it going, everyone? Long time. So I was thinking about the insidious use of copyright And you mentioned the example of filming a documentary and a car goes by with, you know, playing music. Something that was starting to happen in L.A. that the LAPD was doing was they would, when they were having interactions with the public, they would get on their phones and start playing Disney music, because when people were videoing them, they figured Disney's the most litigious company out there when mm-hmm. it comes to copyright.
Yeah, I heard that. I heard that story. It was really both infuriating and clever at the same time.
Right. I mean, yeah, but that's what I thought of was one of the most insidious uses of using these copyright bots against the people, you know, because it's the First Amendment right to film in public, and especially people that are public employees, like the police, and to keep them accountable. And it was a way of trying to skip accountability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's how did that turn out, do you know?
I think it was like a fad, and Disney, like, because like these videos would be posted to YouTube, but Disney had just started giving them a pass on the copyright.
Wow, okay. That's something.
Or it was ruled fair use or something like that, mm-hmm. you know.
It shouldn't have to get to that stage, though. It shouldn't have to, you know, go into the courts or be dependent on a huge corporation to grant permission. You know, it's just, if you're recording something in normal life, you should be able to do that like you always have been.
Yeah, I mean, the famous case was, it was like a little girl's birthday party and a Prince song comes on. And Prince had them take down the video because Prince doesn't want any of his music on YouTube, or he did when he was alive. It's on YouTube now because the state says, yeah, sure, why not? But when Prince was alive, he didn't want any of his music on YouTube.
Okay, I mean, you know, there are limitations to the control you can have over certain things. I certainly think that somebody could say, I don't want my music to appear on Amazon. I don't want my music to appear, excuse me, on YouTube. And, you know, they can take that down. But if something is playing in the background, that's not a duplication of your work. It's just something in the background, like, you know, a sunset or something. And if you're alive on this planet, that could happen to you. You can't get the permission of everybody in a crowd scene to have their faces displayed. I know there are people who think you have to, and they go and they blur out faces of all the people they couldn't get clearance from. But for God's sake, you know that famous photo of, I think it was Coney Island in the 1940s, 1950s, where the beach is just crowded with all these people. Can you imagine if they had to go around every single person and ask for permission? You would not have that photo, and it's magic.
Well, yeah, the part of that you have to realize is it's public spaces. That is totally legal, and if you're in public, you do not have the ability to protect yourself in the way that you would on private property or under the policies of your own residence mm-hmm. and the expectations there. So I think like Coney Island is a public space as public
as
any.
No, yeah,
I don't think it's like private property.
It's pretty damn public, yeah.
On the boardwalk. So if you're photographing there, even if it's commercial, I think you don't necessarily need people's permission, especially like you're talking about for a crowd scene. You may have like policies, especially for a feature length film or a production of that scale. But if you're doing something independently, that would be something I think that you may not have to adhere to the same policies that they have in place, where like a large film that's doing location shooting would have to post things at the very least, so that public entering an area where filming is in progress has at least the awareness that they could be captured on film, and the expectation is that they relinquish their rights in that moment. But
I think, like you say, if it's in public, you just by default don't have those rights. Now, let's say, though, that I'm walking down Coney Island, but this time I'm recording, and somebody's playing a Prince song, and Prince is still alive, and he doesn't want his music anywhere. I don't think he has a say at that point. I really don't, because it's being played in public, and, you know, I'm not there recording his music. I'm there recording the beach and all the people around, and his music just happens to be in the background. And I don't think you can control what people record or share when it's in a public space. I just don't think that's right. Just like, you know, I don't think you have to blur out license plates. I know Google Street View does that. I don't think that's necessary. I think if it's there, it's there. If you see people, they're there as well. I know there's reasons to not want to have people there, and that's fine. But legally, I don't think it's something that should be required.
Yeah, I think you're right. Maybe I'm even granting too much when I'm talking about different scales of, like, production, because the means to do a lot of this is so pervasive. Like, any telephone can begin recording video, and I don't know, I'm thinking about the scenario you're talking about, it is a new work, and there should be protection for what natural sound there is. YouTube may have their own policy or their own strictures because they feel it's a liability to their model because they're distributing so much content with an ad model. But someone producing something on their own, or even a small production or student or documentary or just a private individual, they're bumping up against that on the distribution side, but to produce it, I think you do have any right, and especially in public spaces, to create what is new content. And it isn't that original Prince recording. It is an entire scene visually in time with that as one element of the natural sound. So, yeah, I mean, it's these claims, like, to have the idea that the estate or that an artist would go after an independent or even a feature-length production, it does change when you get into, like, box office sales and all of that, because they have to clear things and do all of this sort of due diligence at that level. But to distribute – and so these issues with, like, YouTube and online services, they're – small examples of what those productions go through. It's just, it's mostly done in the cheapest way possible with like threatening automation or just bans on your accounts on whatever platform it is.
I find it interesting.
But
that
natural
on,
sound should be natural.
But on YouTube, you can find pretty much any song you're looking for that's posted either by record companies or just somebody where it doesn't get taken down. It's just there. And that's fine, you know. It's it proves that it's not that big a deal to have the music out there. Johnny, I'd like to have one more point, then we're going to move on to another phone call. Go ahead.
Yeah. Oh, there is something, though, in Europe, in the EU, under GDPR, your photograph, your face, is considered identifiable information and is protected under the GDPR. So it's a little bit stricter in Europe. For people to publish people's faces.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious what you would define publish. And, I mean, to publish isn't necessarily to identify them or reveal more about them. However, the mere act of publishing could widely distribute something that could make it portable enough for others to use things to identify that individual. So therein is a liability in you distributing more of someone's face like that. So we don't have that here. And, you know, you do not have, like, your face and, as I've said in the past, voice. There's zero expectation of that being protected. And I think this is an example of why we need to hash out some kind of privacy, I don't know, framework or policy goal to think about greater protections in that way while not poisoning the creative marketplace of ideas and new content that's emerging.
John, it was good hearing from you. You've given us a lot to think about. I hope you keep writing articles and hear from you again soon.
Okay, I'll get to work.
All right. Take care. And our phone number, 802-321-4225. For those people who have, that rang fast. Boy, didn't think it was possible to ring. You just hung up the phone a second ago. Okay, well, I guess the line is going to be engaged for a moment or two. Are you ready? And good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, Emmanuel. Calling Rebel. From Portugal.
You're in Portugal. Well, before we get to that, I just want to point out that you weren't number one this time. You're number two. You were the second caller. And you're losing your touch.
Well, I haven't slept at night almost 2 days.
Oh, that must be why.
Well, no, because I wanted to take an Airbus 380, which I never taken. I think it's like the biggest plane, like bigger than the 747. I always wanted to take it, so I had to go to Germany, like Munich, Germany, from New York City.
Yeah, their doors don't pop out, but I think one of them caught fire the other day. Airbus 380, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I think so. But regardless, I'm sure yours was fine. But so you're in Portugal, and you haven't slept for 2 nights. You know, they have a lot of fun in that country. The partying never stops, so don't expect to get any sleep for the next week or so.
Well, I'm only going to be here for a couple of days, and then I'm going to Italy, Ireland, and then London.
Okay, well, one of those is a city, and none of them are connected, well, except Ireland and London.
Well, yeah.
Are you taking trains, or are you flying all the way?
No, I'm flying to Italy, and then flying, and then I'm going to go from Italy, fly to Ireland, and then take a ferry to London, I mean to England, and then take a train to London.
Okay, well, at least you take a train at some point. And I imagine you might be going through Wales when you cross over on the ferry, right?
I guess. I mean, I haven't planned it out yet, but
Well, when you look at the map, make sure to see if you're in Wales, and if you do wind up in Wales, spend some time there.
Yeah, I do plan on spending time. Okay. My question to you is, I registered for Hope, so I'm going to be at the Hope Conference in July.
Cool.
My question to you is, you know Telnet, right? Like, is this the way Telnet works? Is that if I was at, let's say, Harvard and you were at Stony Brook, and let's say you came to visit me at Harvard and you wanted to log on to your Stony Brook account, you'd use Telnet to log in?
Well, yes, that is true. If it was 1990, I don't think anybody uses Telnet anymore. Everyone uses...
No, they don't use it anymore,
right.
No. But that's the way it used to work. Let's say Stony Brook uses a D.
The old UNIVAC. Yeah, I know.
Old UNIVAC, but let's say it's 1988 or 90 or 91, and Stony Brook used a DEC mainframe, and Princeton used an IBM.
I don't think they had a DEC mainframe. They might have had a VAX, but I know they had a UNIVAC. Gila, do you have some information on this?
No, I have a different question from a listener, but I said I would ask it when Rebel talks.
Yeah, let's let
Rebel,
Rebel get
so,
through.
Now's my moment.
Yeah, just talk. Let Rebel get through his. Otherwise, he hasn't slept in 2 days.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So if, let's say you had two different terminal systems, you could log on to your system. Like if you were in Princeton, you could log on to the system at Stony Brook, right?
Well, that was the idea. The idea was to be able to connect. And, you know, what was cool, and what you can't do anymore, you used to be able to run a talk window. And the way that worked is you would type talk followed by the account at the school address. So, it would be sunysb.edu or something. And even predated actual internet addresses like that. But what would happen was your screen would split in half. You'd be on the top, and the person you're talking to would be on the bottom, and you could both type at the same time and have a little conversation there in the window. That command still exists on many Unix systems, but it's been disabled pretty much everywhere because of security reasons. But I think it was one of the coolest things about being on the early days of the Internet, because you could talk to people all around the world, and there weren't other ways of doing that at the time.
Now, can systems disable Telnet? Like, if Stony Brook didn't want anybody to Telnet to them, they could disable
it. I'm pretty sure it's disabled everywhere. I don't know of anything I can Telnet to.
No, I'm saying back then. I'm talking about the 90s.
Oh, back then, maybe. Alex, you have something. Go ahead.
Yeah, you could always disable Telnet. Mm-hmm. It operated on port 23 as opposed. And then Telnet mostly became really deprecated when SSH took off. The problem with Telnet was that everything happened in clear text, right? So you could sniff out, if you were packet sniffing on a network, you could sniff out people's passwords as they entered them on the remote system to which they were Telnetting. But there are still some places to which you can Telnet, Emmanuel, which are kind of cool. And in fact, I think Telnet is mostly used these days, as I understand it, to operate Telnet-based BBSs.
Okay, yeah, that's true. That's cool. True. So they do still use that particular service occasionally. Yeah. And, you know, Kyle just pointed this out to me, and it's important to point out there. Telnet is not Telenet. Telenet is a service right. That was run by GTE at one point, and it was a packet-based switch network back in the 80s. So, yeah, a lot of people got confused by that, but Telnet, Telenet, two different things. But, yeah, Telnet is still a command that works if you want to connect to something.
Yeah, it used to be a way to get to management stuff on different hardware to check or otherwise set something up, like on a switch or something, or various things will use that, and you can still launch it in some operating systems.
You know what
I'm sure.
You know what I like about Telnet that I don't like about SSH? SSH pretty much is a replacement for Telnet.
Yes.
You could type Telnet, hit return, and get a Telnet prompt. And then you would type O for open, followed by a space and the address. And if somebody also logged into your system who types the W command to see who else is on the system, it shows what you're running. When you did that, it would show that you were running Telnet. As opposed to if you did it all on the command line, you could type telnet space followed by the address you were going to. And then if that person ran W to see who was on the system, they would see you running telnet and also see what you're connecting to. SSH, its replacement, that uses encryption, you can't hit SSH and hit return and get an SSH prompt. You have to type the whole thing. So therefore, you're giving away that information to anybody who types W to see who's on the system. And I don't know why they never had just an SSH prompt, because that would have been another layer of security. I'm sure there's something I'm missing. But, Gila, is this concerning Rebel? Or
it's a question for Rebel.
Question for Rebel. Okay, Rebel, get ready for a question.
All right. Rebel, the question in the chat is, Rebel is quite the traveler. What European country do you like the most?
Oh.
Amsterdam.
That's not a country. For God's sake, you went there. You got to know it's not a country. It's a city. Man, don't piss me off like this. Come on. You know better.
About to tell me, this is Telnet.
Well,
I can't get through to people. I can't get through to people at all. Go ahead, Rebel. Just talk about Telnet.
Remember in the 80s when you go to an airline terminal and they, you know, you give them your credit card and they swipe your credit card? You know, the computer terminals that were hooked up to the mainframe. How did they verify the credit cards? Did they use a Telnet type of a system where they similar type of system where they log into the credit cards?
Well, I mean, there used to be all sorts of ways of verifying credit card numbers, and also just assuming the credit card was correct. There's an algorithm, or basically, I think the way the system works is you add up all the numbers, and they have to add up to a certain number that's a checksum, I believe, of the last digit. I don't know. This is so long ago that I remember this particular formula. And we printed it back in old issues of 2600. There was some kind of calculation you could do or a computer could do to say if this is a valid format for a credit card. Like, you know, we know that Visa begins with 4, MasterCard begins with 5, but this went beyond that. This took the whole number, and if it added up to a certain amount or was divisible by a certain amount, then it was... at least it passed that test, but there was no guarantee it wasn't being used fraudulently. Then there were also these books that came out every month, And these books were filled with credit card numbers that I think were fraudulent. So when you made a purchase, oftentimes the merchant would consult that book and see if the number was on there. That's a very crude system. But back then, credit card fraud was nowhere near what it is now, so they didn't really have to have it updated to the moment, but that was the best they could do. Another way of verifying, and this was probably the most fun, a merchant would make a phone call to a credit card company. And if you ever overheard the phone call, it was really amazing. It was pretty comical. They would start, the person would pick up on the other end. They wouldn't say hello or anything. They would just read off their merchant number to verify that they had the right to call in the first place. The person on the other end would say, okay. Then they would read the credit card number. And then the person on the other end of the phone, if the credit card number was valid, would give them a confirmation code. So the whole conversation was basically two people exchanging numbers back and forth. And that was how a lot of credit card verification worked back then.
Okay, now, was this the way the computer terminals in the airports worked back in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, where instead of them calling, the computer's not making a phone call, but it's basically calling the Visa company or American Express?
Are you talking about for the airline?
Automatic, yeah.
You're talking about what the airline would have done?
Yeah.
Yeah, they probably because of the volume of authorizations that they would have to be doing, they probably linked in mm-hmm. their business systems totally. That was probably some of the earliest sort of retail models that required just a higher level of integration with the merchant service provider.
Most definitely. Gayla, did you have something else?
But in to say that C. Kermit is the same thing that he's talking about with Telnet, but it also has SSH baked in. And I do still have a question for you guys, which we'll get to when Rebel's off the phone.
Okay. Rebel, one more question or point from you, and then we're going to move on.
Do you remember police call? Like, back in the 80s, before the Bell system breakup, like, you would pick up the phone and dial the local operator and make a local call. You'd tell a police call, and you'd give her any four digits and say that that was a badge number, and they put calls through.
I never heard of that. And I know you always would talk about privilege calls that would make the operator do the work that most people would do on their own for you, and they would just dial numbers at your command. I never heard of a police call like that. What was the intent of that?
Well, how did the TFTS system verify the calling cards when people entered them back then?
It's like I'm not talking at all. I don't know. Rebel, it's been a joy as always. Always good to hear your voice, and maybe you don't hear mine, but thanks for calling, and enjoy Portugal and the rest of Europe, countries and cities that you wind up in. Hopefully be able to tell the difference. That would be nice. Okay, is our phone line clear? Okay. 802-321-4225. 802-321-HACK. Gayla, go ahead with your question.
Okay. The question is, how was the van acquired? And was it bought from the phone company? Is the van still somewhere? And my question, not from the listener, is do we call it the dodgy van because of who made it?
Okay, I'm just going to ignore that last one. but I will say that the van was obtained legitimately at a phone company auction where all these old phone company trucks and cars were being auctioned. I think it was, I want to say Westbury, Long Island, Nassau County. Basically, we went there the day before to look at all the vans that were out there. Every single one of them had all the paint scraped off, so it didn't look like much. And we got to climb inside and see, you know, what certain vans had and what certain vans didn't have. Some were in good condition, some were in bad condition. This particular van was the one we chose for a couple of reasons. First, it didn't have very many miles on it. I think it was around 80,000, which really wasn't that much for a phone company van that had been used for a number of years. This was, by the way, in 1993 that we did this. And we saw a number of vans that were similar. In particular, there was a van right next to this one that was extremely similar. The only difference was the one that we took an interest in was manual transmission, and the other one was automatic. We used that to our advantage because nobody wanted to drive manual transmission, especially in a van that had no power steering and no air conditioning. And it was a workout, absolutely. But it's a workout that people who drive vehicles enjoy, right, Kyle? We like driving manual.
Yeah, it's actually in pretty good shape, and we've noted various places where there is some metalwork that needs to be done long term.
Yeah, they all had that. They all had.
But it's stored safely and will be in action, I think, this summer.
Oh yeah, you'll see it at Hope for sure.
Of course,
it's at the last Hope, it'll be at this Hope. So,
yeah, the shifting is great though. Like we've dialed that in. We had some help.
But let me get back to the auction because the reason we chose manual was because knowing how to drive manual first of all is a great thing, and that's something else. The people disdain manual because they want the car to do everything for them. And I say learn how to drive manual because you have so much more control over the vehicle and you'll be able to feel problems a lot easier. And, it's another example of how old technology is being rejected in favor of the technology that does it all for you.
Also, the cost of ownership, like an automatic transmission has its own implications.
Mm-hmm.
As far as maintenance, the kinds of fluids you need to deal with, and it requires a different level of mechanical know-how and cost, right? To buy a brand new or replacement of that, the convenience, I think, over time would have perhaps, showed its difference.
Maybe,
whereas, getting a manual transmission rebuilt or serviced or just the sort of simplicity of it, I think, makes it unique.
And
we
had to get a new clutch at one point. I do know that. So that was pricey.
Yeah, yeah. But the familiarity with it, you don't need to be a specialist in automatic transmissions is what I'm saying.
And it's funny because after getting the new clutch, they moved reverse. Reverse used to be you'd shift to the right and down. That was reverse. Now you shift to the left and up. And the funny thing is, when I got the van back from the mechanic, they didn't tell me that. And so the first time I'm trying to go into reverse, I'm like, where did it go? I can't get into reverse no matter what. And I had to call them to find out what they did. So then that's when I learned. But getting back to the auction, the van next to us that was pretty similar but automatic, that went for thousands of dollars, and people really got into a bidding war about that. Our van, the next one, nobody else wanted it. And we got it for about $900. It was a steal, and something I have never regretted. That van is a real trooper. Engine is in great shape, and it's seen a lot. It's seen a lot and made a lot of people happy. And then, of course, the next part of this was getting it painted back into the colors that were scraped off and getting the vinyl put on just the right way. Funny thing is, we had the colors, the stripes, that were identical to New York Telephone trucks. And they'd wave at us when we passed by, thinking we were one of them. And it was just, everyone thought, hey, that's the phone company, because from the front there were no logos, just the stripes, so it definitely looked like that. And then after a couple of years, New York Telephone ceased to exist and just got drawn into 9X. And they had different stripes. They didn't have the same stripes. So all of a sudden, we had the only van with those stripes. It was pretty awesome that... That was the case, that somehow we won this battle. Although, to this day, phone company guys still wave at the van. I don't know if they've been working that long and they recognize it was just something that's ingrained in our DNA, but it still has that feel to it.
Yeah, and it's recognizable, right? It's that familiarity. And it probably needs a wash, but other than that, we'll get it nice and shiny and polish it, show off a little. It's such a useful vehicle and still proves its use.
Yeah, we've moved many people's homes in that van.
Equipment, phone booths.
Uh-huh. We had Club Mate Day with the band.
Soda.
Yeah.
Magazines.
We drove it to Dayton at least once. No, we drove it a few times to Dayton.
It's
Dayton,
been
Ohio,
to Dayton.
For the hamvention. My God.
Yeah, it's a very interesting model, the inline engine. It's not a V. It's got some unique quirks. There's probably some interior stuff that needs some rehab.
And we have a ladder that goes on it. We don't usually put the ladder on it,
yes.
We usually put megaphones on it instead.
And we have an amber light that we're going to debut, I believe, at some point.
I hope that answers all the questions about the van. Do we have another phone call?
Yes, someone's on the line. They've been waiting.
I'm sorry about that. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime. Go ahead.
Yes, I have some comments about things you said on the air.
Go ahead.
Would like to get a television for privacy and security reasons that I use not connected to the Internet.
Okay, fair enough.
Yes, so that means that none of these things would apply as long as it cooperates with that.
Well, I mean, you can get an over-the-air television set that will just receive the digital signals as they are now, using the right kind of antenna and all that. Rob, you were mentioning how expensive the actual non-smart monitors are these days. Do you have any recommendations here?
No particular recommendations, but the commercial displays that you would get, and you would get that if you were like had a business and you wanted TV screens, but you didn't want all the smart TV nonsense on them. And like if you go into a restaurant and their menu is on a screen or whatever, that's the sort of thing I'm talking about. But there is also the option, which may be a hassle to do, but that is to get just any TV off the shelf, take it home, start it up, and just never put it on the Internet.
Yeah,
we still have that ability. And the TV will complain. You'll switch it on, and it'll go, hey, what's your Wi-Fi password? And if you just don't enter it, it'll probably keep asking you. But and you may have to say no every time. But, you know, you do have the ability to just never put it on the damn net in the first place, and therefore it can't transmit anything to you, but it also can't transmit anything from you. And you could just hook that TV up to some sort of other device that will be showing you, you know, whatever digital stuff you want to watch, or you could receive over-the-air digital signals if you have the right antenna.
How often will it ask for my Wi-Fi password?
Depends on the brand, I bet.
Yeah, I think that's about it. It depending on the brand, it could be often, it could be just once, it could be anywhere in between, and there is unfortunately no way to know.
Go ahead.
I want to find out before I buy it whether it will
work. Yeah, that's you know what, for that that's something the Internet can help you with. If you ask around and make that clear and ignore the people that say, why do you want to do this and this is stupid, just say, this is what I want, can anyone help me? I'm sure on Reddit or something you'll find someone who's done the same thing and can recommend something, because there are lots of people that want what you want. Go ahead, Rob.
Another option you might have would be if you're going to go into a store rather than ordering online, if you're going to just walk into a shop where they have TVs on display and ask the person there to show you, like, can you tell me what would happen if we start this one up but don't put it online? They might be willing to take one of their TVs and take it offline and show you what happens.
You know what actually might be kind of interesting on this? What do prisons do? Because prisons sure don't want Wi-Fi connecting to their TV sets, and you know, they have TV sets. I guess maybe they have those expensive ones or something like that, but that might be a place to look.
I was also going to suggest using projector. I don't know if people still use projectors at all, or if that's not satisfactory as far as viewing quality, but if you're just trying to get information from a source, that's a possible way to go as well.
I still have my grandmother's old TV set from the 1980s, or early 1980s, and it still works. It never has broken once. Of course, I haven't used it in the last a couple of decades, but I imagine there's a conversion that you can apply that will allow it to receive TV signals. Am I incorrect on that? I haven't tried.
There's a box for over-the-air signals.
I'm sorry?
can get a box for over-the-air signals.
Right.
Like a converter box.
Yeah, so, I mean, technically, oh, wow, it's in this room, Kyle? I didn't realize it was, Kyle's just turned on the TV set, which apparently has been sitting here the whole time, and I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, it's here. It's
why
it's
is it
in,
here? We need
it's plugged
space.
Into a Sony VCR. I don't have a lot of storage. I got to build some shelves.
Okay.
But, right. Yeah.
That's right. You can plug a VCR into it. That'll still work.
And you can get converters, as was mentioned, I believe, that will take sort of widescreen, like 16:9 aspect ratio stuff, and will squeeze it. There's lots of different products available to do that. We've done that. And we've also hooked up, like, the DV camera, which is the original Freedom Downtime camera.
That's right.
And we've projected that through the VCR and out of this TV. And through other monitors, like smaller monitors.
This is why you don't throw out old hardware. You can always have fun with it.
You can play with this stuff and it may, like, make it, retrofit it with some of the tools and devices that we have now and repurpose it in fun ways.
Did we help with your question?
That was you, I think you helped with some of the things you said. By the way, about Freedom Downtime, on the WBAI website, when you click off the hook on the schedule, it says that you recently directed Freedom Downtime.
I guess that's an old description. That's the only thing I can think of, because that was a while ago. That was at least, 25 years ago. Wow.
About VPNs, which you also talked about, there's a warning on EFF.org. There's an article about a vulnerability of VPNs if you use them in unfamiliar networks.
Does anyone want to talk about the security, possible security risk to the user of VPNs? No?
I will say it's one tool that you can use amidst, and it can be a part of a combination of things that you use. But, yeah, buyer beware for some of these services, and be on your toes, and, of course, don't set unrealistic expectations of something that is sold to you, especially if it's free. the ways and the kinds of networks that you use this on and for what purposes could leave some gaps in what your expectations might be.
Again, go online, see what's recommended, see what has a good track record, see what's been around for a while, and make a decision based on that. We're going to move on. Thanks.
VPNs are vulnerable to something called tunnel vision, an attack that you can do. It's on in the article. And you used to be able to adjust, if you wanted to be as if you were in a different geographical location, you just used to be able to just find a proxy server somewhere that you could connect to or through.
Right. Yeah, that's gotten harder. That's for sure.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, right. And like I said, it's not foolproof, and there are attacks, and it is because it is used for so many different purposes. It is something that is desirable for gleaning information about how it's used or what kind of information is traversing it.
Thanks for the call. We're going to move on. Take care.
Okay. Thanks.
And we're going to take one more phone call because we're tired and we've been at this for a while. 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACK, be that last phone call, and we will conclude after that. Hope Conference coming up. We have received all of the speaker entries, and wow, we have some great speaker entries, and we're looking forward to publishing the rest of the schedule. A good part of the talks are already announced. I think we're about halfway through at this point. So there'll be a lot more showing up there. We have Cory Doctorow coming. We have all kinds of amazing people speaking. And that's not all. We're having workshops. We're having villages. We're having all kinds of fun at St. John's University, July 12th through 14th. All the information is on hope.net. And I think we have another phone call coming in. This will be the last phone call of the night. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook Overtime.
We have received.
Yes, go ahead. You're on. Please turn down your device.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a quick general question. Where do I get information on the upcoming Pope conference? Is there a website or something?
It's funny because I just said that. I guess you were calling at the time. Yes, the website is hope.net, hope.net, and that should tell you everything you need to know.
Okay, that's all I need to know. Thank you.
Okay. Well, that was an easy phone call, and that means we're going to get out of here a little bit earlier. So thank you, everybody, for calling in, for listening. Of course, you can write to us, oth@2600.com. Plan ahead. 2600 meetings are not this Friday, but the one afterwards. Right, Rob?
Absolutely. And also keep showing your support for WBAI at give2wbai.org.
Yes, and pledge for that off-the-hook thing, the collection, every show we've ever done on a flash drive. It's pretty interesting.
Anthology.
That's the word I was searching for.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Good night.